what I'm actually trying to show with my life is that you can just be and just live and do the things that truly excite you and live outside of other people's expectations of you, because that's when you become impossible to ignore.
Welcome to Create Belonging. My name is Matteo Bornico, and this is the podcast where we explore the world through the lens of belonging. Let me ask you a question. If you could start over your career, what would you choose? I know at some point of my life, I wanted to be a travel writer or a photographer or even a published author. How about being a professional speaker on the TED stage? When I thought of being more practical, I thought about becoming an entrepreneur or even go back to school and get a degree in computer engineering. Well, my guest today has been all those things and even more. This is a person that is a true polymath. And when asked to do a TEDx talk, it was on the idea of why not? An attitude of embracing possibilities and overcoming barriers. And it's this attitude of why not that has taken my guest around the world from being a US graduate in computer engineering to being a travel writer, a published author, or even a photojournalist that was published in National Geographic. And yes, my guest today is none other than the amazing Lola Akimade Okastrom. Lola is a Nigerian-born Stockholmer. She is a Black woman who defies stereotypes and actively strives to make others find their belonging by being a beacon, an example, and a role model for others to follow. In this conversation, we touch on many aspects of Lola's life and work. We cover a bit of her backstory, and we talk about the importance of defining home beyond the confines of a place. And then we continue our talking about her books and her work. In particular, we talk about her first major publication. It's a book called Lagom, The Swedish Secret to Living Well. For those that aren't familiar with the term lagom, this is a Swedish word. It's often translated as just the right amount, or not too much, or not too little. In many ways, lagom describes the value of temperance that always seems to be imbued in Swedish life. And later we talk briefly about her first fiction book entitled In Every Mirror She's Black, which was released back in 2021. And it's a book that describes Swedish society from the perspective of being a Black woman. Actually, being three different Black women with different backgrounds. More recently, she published a sequel to this first book that is called Everything Is Not Enough, which was released earlier this year. And aside from her books, we cover other topics. I ask her about what she thinks about tokenism or her responsibility of being a role model for other Black women or people in the margins living here in the Nordics. This was a wide-ranging conversation. It was a rich conversation full of wonderful insights from a person that not only has created belonging for herself, but that also embodies belonging and shows many people that may feel marginalized that they belong. There are, of course, lots of show notes and links for you to find her books. So please head over to createbelonging.com or wherever you find the show notes for this podcast. And I'm sure there's a link there that will get you to the right place. Okay. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Lola Okastrom to Create Belonging. Lola, welcome to Create Belonging.
Oh, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
I've learned about your work in your TED talk, TEDx talk that you did, was perhaps the first contact I've had with you. But in many ways, I am so glad I found you, because I knew somebody like you existed. And having you here in Stockholm was even more special. So when I had this opportunity to come and meet you, I jumped on the occasion. And so I want to thank you for making the time.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to hear and really excited to be here.
So I wanted to start off on the other side of the world. And you said at one point you were about waist deep in, I guess, in the jungles or...
Yes.
In Fiji.
Yes, in Fiji.
Can you tell me what you were doing there?
So this was 2002. At the time, I was working as a programmer. And I happened to be flipping through the newspaper. At that time, internet wasn't that big. So flipping through the newspaper, and I saw an ad with a company called the Eco Challenge. And they were running an expedition race in Fiji. And they wanted to find volunteers to volunteer and work with them on this expedition race. So I applied, you know, and that was how I ended up in Fiji. And my job was to follow the contestants around as a volunteer. So if they were paddling in the ocean, you know, open ocean, we were like in a boat next to them, asking them how they were doing. You know, if they were mountain biking, we were like in a bus going, how are you feeling? Because we were going to write stories about them, share it every day on the site, as well as write about Fiji and the amazing places we're exploring. So that was why when I was standing in the middle of a river, it hit me that, oh my God, this is one of the most amazing experiences of my life. And people get paid to do this. So that was kind of how I started getting into travel writing and photography. So
it's many people's dream to become a travel writer and photographer. I think it's probably one of the top professions that, you know, if you just were to ask people, what do you dream of if you could do anything? I think that's it. And you happen to be one of those people who have made it work.
Yes, you know, and it's hard work, but I'm really grateful to be able to follow my passion this way. Yes.
And tracing back the steps, you've applied from when you were living in the States, right?
Yes.
And what were you doing in the United States?
So I grew up in Nigeria, and when I was 15, I moved to the U.S. to start college. Mm. So that was kind of why I ended up there. I went to university there for both my degrees, and then started working as a programmer at 19. So I was done with my first degree then.
Wow.
Started working as a programmer, and that was kind of where I started building my first, I guess, career, you know, as a GIS programmer and a system architect. And that was how I ended up in the U.S.
Okay, yeah, and being a programmer, it's very, you can say it's very left brain, very absolutes, either you got it right or wrong, yes or no, very, very fixed. But now you're in a more creative context where you're a photographer, you're very in tune to people's feelings, how they're reacting to your work. And how is that transition? Why, how did you figure that you wanted to abandon that, you know,
correct,
that old work and move in towards this more creative side, correct, of yours?
So, I mean, you know, the misconception is that people think programming is just super logical, but it's actually also very creative. And what I did back then was I was programming interactive maps. So something called GIS. Think of it like Google Maps. So it was really exciting, right? But I've always been a creative person. You know, growing up in Nigeria, I've always written. I've always written fiction. And I've always painted. You know, I used to be an oil painter. And so I knew that that part of me was going to win in the long run. And so when I got into travel photography, it was just to actually bring photos back to paint from. Mm. And then I realized, you know what, I could actually explore photography as a new medium, you know, for expression. So that's kind of how I started moving into the creative side of my brain. And you know, that took over in the long run.
You mentioned writing in Nigeria, and through being exposed to your work and just being exposed to other voices, I discovered a few Nigerian writers, some of them very huge reputation, especially in America.
Yes.
And you probably follow along those footsteps, which is so amazing. The person I'm thinking of I forgot what her name is.
Is it Chimamanda?
Yes, Chimamanda, yes. Of course. Thank you. Yeah, I'm not very good at remembering names, but we'll probably edit that part out. And you were not put into a box early on. It feels like you allowed the freedom to express yourself, whether it was through painting or through writing. Is that coming from your household, from your parents, or what was that like?
Yeah, so I would say it does come from my family. My family is a really kind of worldly family, so they traveled a lot. We traveled a lot. My grandfather used to be in the shipping business, so he traveled a lot as well, even to Greenland in the 70s.
Sure.
You know, and my dad is a geologist, so he traveled all over the world, you know, in that field. So in a sense, we had a bit of freedom, a bit of world global view as a family.
Yeah.
Even though I went to the U.S. and studied IT, you know, I still was allowed to be myself. And so when I moved to the U.S., I already had a strong sense of self before, you know, coming into a society that kind of wanted to box me in.
Yes.
And so I kind of fought against that. I'm like, you can't box me in because I'm not boxing myself in. So why would you?
Yeah.
So.
And yeah, I have so many ways we can take this conversation. But I wanted to, one of the concepts about belonging that we talk about is the concept of home. Can you tell me, what does home mean to you?
So, you know, home really for me is something that evolved over time. And that's because, you know, living in Nigeria and then in the US and then in Sweden and then traveling to so many different countries, home ended up being a space. So not so much a place, but a space where I can exist without explanation.
Yeah.
And for me, when I moved to the U.S., I started finding kind of spaces that I feel at home in. So, for example, I used to play rugby, so my rugby community feels like home.
Yes.
I can just exist there without explaining, you know. Or my Nigerian community, especially my tribe Yoruba, feels like home because I can exist without explaining. Some parts of Sweden can feel like home, especially in my little networks, because I don't have to explain myself. So for me, I kind of detached home from place and attached it to space.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess by space is getting in beyond the it's in the metaphysical space.
Yes.
That could be a spiritual place.
Yes.
It could be, yeah.
Exactly. So a space where not only my soul thrives and feels like it can just be, but also that I mentally accept that it's a space for me as well. So both of them have to align.
Yeah, talk to me about being in a place where you're allowed to exist without explanation. Can you dive a little bit deeper what you mean by that?
So what that means is, as a Black woman, there are many places where the minute I step in, the look I get or the energy I am presented with instantly tells me I'm not supposed to be in that space, even though I am worthy enough to be in that space.
Yes.
And so that's what I mean is, I need to be in a place where I don't get that energy. I don't feel like this space is for somebody else, even though maybe I deserve to be in that space more than other people. So for me, that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it is a place where you are just celebrated for existing. You do not have to prove yourself. You do not have to work 2, 3, 4 times as hard. You know, you can be vulnerable. You can cry. You can just be broken without judgment, right? Because I think with Black women, we always have to always show we're strong, always show that, you know, we are capable and we have to work harder than everybody else. And we can do so much with very, very little resources, you know. And so I think we're kind of tired of that.
Yeah.
And saying that, you know, we need to be in spaces where we can just be and then thrive and be celebrated for just being.
You mentioned energy, and a recent blog post of yours was about, it was just titled, I'm Exhausted. And what I loved about it is that it was very simplistic, and for good reason, because indeed you were exhausted. And you said, and I think you said something along the lines of, you know why I'm exhausted. And this idea of not being given the benefit of the doubt. When you walk into a room, you have to prove yourself. There's countless examples of, you know, whistling Vivaldi or leading with your resume, which is whenever a person, a minority, has to prove themselves and say, oh, well, I studied in Harvard. And like within the first few sentences, in order for to gain the credibility that is given to somebody, for example, like me, who's white and male. And so then home is where you recharge or where you're able to find that balance.
Yeah, I like that. The home is where you can recharge. Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
Okay. How many directions where we can go? Maybe I'll let you choose. We can talk about Lagom. We could talk about boxes. Or we could talk about nuances and details.
We can talk about all of them, you know.
Okay. Well, early in your conversations, you said about being put into a box. And we live in a very frantic world, very frenetic, where you are a person that wears many hats. You were a programmer. You were a photographer. You still are probably a programmer. You probably are still a photographer. You are a writer. And I don't know what other talents you are. You're a mother. You are an immigrant. You are a citizen. But when we meet, you only have a few seconds. And you know somebody's making an impression of you. How do you handle that? That people tend to put you in boxes. And how do you handle that tension of them not getting the full picture of you?
You know, over time, I've learned actually not to care about first impressions because we are all multidimensional people, complex beings. And for me to judge somebody on a 10-minute of maybe them not being their best, I wrote a piece recently about kind of metaphorical mirrors, where when we hold up mirrors that somebody else has created for us, so a stereotype, we fight against that stereotype, right? We work twice as hard to show that that mirror is not me. But if I judge somebody on a first impression, I'm doing the same thing. I'm holding up a stereotypical mirror in front of that person. So I personally do not believe in first kind of impressions. I know the world still does. And that is what you have to reconcile. And for me, if people want to dismiss me after just one first impression, then maybe that's not my people, right? Because I look for depth. People are not one-dimensional, and society forces us to be one-dimensional to make that crucial first impression, which I feel like it's ludicrous. We are all beautiful, complex, multidimensional beings. And if I'm having a shitty 5 minutes and you meet me then and you feel like that's who I am as a person, then that's it. But then you're missing out on the depth, on the nuance, on the details, on the lived experiences of what this person can bring to the table. So that's kind of how I think. I'm not a first impression kind of person. I am a benefit of doubt kind of person. I will give the person time to show me more levels of themselves before I can make an opinion on the person.
And I think that's very reflective on your work. You're both your photography, your travel journaling, you have a way to capture the nuances and you go deep really quick. Like, for example, the work that you've done, I think, with fishermen in Croatia, I believe. And you have a way of just getting to those details that is what people miss from in this fast-paced world. And I think we're so craving for people to see, to help us see the multidimensionals of people. And I think you managed to capture that beautifully in your work and in your observations. And you come from a country where there is, I believe, over 200 tribes. Yes. And you identified yourself for being from one tribe and maybe your next door neighbor has also a different background, but yet you all are neighbors and you coexist. And I guess that prepared you to have this perspective of understanding different views and then to see that the picture is much more complex than it is on the surface. Which brings me to one of your seminal works, which is Lagom. And that book is, apart from being very beautiful, I mean, there's lots of your photographic storytelling, and it carries a wide variety of topics. It explains the Swedish mentality, but it goes a little bit more deeper than that. And can you tell me why Lagom is just not simply living a balanced life? Or
yes, no, yeah. Absolutely. And you know, Lagom, it became a trend a few years ago around the world because the world was looking for the next kind of Scandinavian trend to jump on. But for me, Lagom has always been a lot more nuanced because a lot of Swedes don't like it. Hmm. And a lot of Swedes tell me it's just a word. And I say, if it's just a word, then why don't you like it? That means there's something about this word, right? Yes. And so I started digging deeper. And right before I wrote this book, 3 years before I wrote this book, I did a deep piece for a magazine called Roads and Kingdoms, you know, and Slate. And it was a deep dive into Lagom that said, I think it was called The Silence of the Swedes. That was the title of it. And it went into what was this unspoken rule that governed society. And that was when I started digging objectively into what Lagom is. So if you think of Lagom as a scale, right? If you put too much pressure on the scale, you're stressing the scale. If you put little, it's still stressing the scale. So you have to keep that scale balanced. And so what Lagom as an ethos is, it's trying to remove stress within your control. That is just what it is on the surface. Now, if you put this in your individual life, it's a fantastic ethos because it's trying to create a life for you that you can maintain and sustain by removing stress out, you know, within your control. But if you move that same scale into a group setting, it's trying to do the same thing, right? It's trying to remove stress. And that's where it morphs into Jante and tries to kind of, you know, remove people's own levels of Lagom to say, you're stressing me, tone yourself down. It tries to create a more homogeneous kind of society, which doesn't work. So it's kind of, you know, the same side, you know, it's like a different side of the same coin, where on one end it's good, on the other end it's bad.
Now, the bad side, that you briefly mentioned the word Jante. Now, I'm assuming not all my listeners understand where Jantelagom comes from. Can you just give us a quick summary of what is Jantelagom?
Yeah, so Jante, it's called kind of the law of Jante, and it's based on a quote-unquote fictional book that was written by a Danish author about a town where they had rules, you know, amongst the folk that, you know, you shouldn't feel like you're better than us, you shouldn't feel like you're anybody, you need to stay in line. And all these laws are actually kind of the Nordic way of thinking in society. And I think it extends into Norway and Denmark as well. It's this way of keeping society manageable so people don't stick out too much, right? But in my observation, because I believe immigrants, especially those that are kind of in that space between speaking the language well but can't fluently speak it, are the most observational people in a society. Because not only can you speak the language, but you are not there yet, so you have to really observe and look for nuance and try to figure out.
I wanted to pause the conversation here for a second or two. And I wanted to try out kind of a hyperlink in audio. So what Lola right now is describing is something that my previous guest, Seven Eselasi, talked about in depth in the previous episode. And that is the idea that those living in the margins have a richness of perspective. And because of this richness of perspective, they have a more objective way of looking at the world. And it is for this reason that Lola perhaps might be much better qualified to talk about a concept like Lagom than any Swede that was born and raised here. So I hope those of you that have listened to every single episode so far have caught on that and are able to make that connection. If not, I just made it for you. So you're welcome. Okay, let's get back to the show.
And so me writing this book objectively, I was able to figure out the nuance of Law, Gum, and Yante and how they work and realize they are the same thing, except in two different contexts. So Law, Gum, again, it's removing stress within your control in your life, which makes it fantastic. But then once it moves into a group setting, because my long gum is not your law gum, it's trying to make me live my best life, then I take my best life into a group setting, and my best life may be better than your own best life, and that's where the stress comes in, and then it tries to dampen me. So it's an ethos that works against itself also.
Sure. You know? There's so many parables that we can make between logom and belonging.
Yes.
And you mention it time after time on your book, almost to remind the reader that logom is a very personal thing. Everybody's definition of logom, just like the definition of belonging, is very deeply personal. And the problem that we have with belonging is this is how I feel like belonging, and now I'm going to take it out to the world, and this is how everybody should feel like belonging. And that's when we get into trouble. We're denying people's individual experiences. In the example of belonging, is we impose rules upon others. This is what you need to do to belong. Yeah. When in reality, people already belong. Yeah. Yeah. That's why this book really resonated with this podcast, with the work I'm trying to do. And you are one of those people who are creating belonging, not just for yourself, because you have definitely found your belonging. Perhaps the moment you picked up a camera or going back to that moment in Fiji, you said, well, this is where I belong. This is what I want to be doing. But you're helping others. And you're helping others, find their belonging. And so that, I guess, I wanted to talk a little bit about your next book. So tell me about this book.
Absolutely. So the book is called In Every Mirror She's Black. And when I wrote Law, Gum, it was a more objective, this is what it is. And then I wanted to write, okay, what does it feel like to live with this ethos in a society that's dominated by white? And then as a black woman, is it a society that allows you to just survive or thrive? And so I get a lot of friends that ask me, what's it like living as a black woman in the US versus living in Europe? Huge difference, very huge difference. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to write about it. And not only that, I'm going to write it from three different points of views. So you can see that black women are not monoliths. Yes. Their experiences are very different. They also have some privileges as well. And they also have not that many privileges as well. And so the book follows three women. You know, one is Kemi, who is a marketing executive in the US. So she's a high-powered lady. And she is brought to Sweden by the guy, Yoni, in the book, who connects all three women. So he runs a marketing firm in Sweden. It's the biggest and is a millionaire. And that marketing firm had a racial kind of PR disaster. And so it goes to the US to go poach Kemi, because she's the best in the US at her job, to come help him with diversity in Sweden. And then on the way over, he meets Brittany, who is a former model flight attendant, and he becomes obsessed with her. And that's kind of that relationship.
Let's not get any spoilers.
Exactly.
But I'm already.
Yeah, no, I know.
I'm already so captivated by the story, but don't spoil
no,
it.
No spoiling. And then Muna is a Somali refugee who comes to Sweden and ends up as a janitor at his company. And so that's all three women. They interact maybe sometimes, you'll see in the book, but the story is told through all three different points of views. And so the book interrogates class, career, and culture in what I call the most open society run by the most private people.
Wow. Yeah, that reminds me of power dynamics is one of the things that's very touched upon. So being powered is very relative. It's something that I have compared to something. If there's nothing to compare it to, that there is no power. And one of the things I am reminded of is this idea of we tend to differentiate between the people with power at the center and the people in the margins that have less power. And the people on the margins, the farther you go away from that center, the less power you have, right? Because the resources are in the middle. And if you could imagine who would be sitting in the middle, everybody would point to a European, white, male, heterosexual. Yes. Yeah. And in Sweden, there would be Swedes. And everybody else wants to get to that power, to that center. But we have all these layers and barriers that forbid us to get it. But what's missing is the idea that the people in the center are all looking at the center. And everybody tends to be looking at the center. So the closer you are, the less perspective you have. And it's the people that are on the outsides and the margins that have a greater perspective. They could see multiple sides of the same story. They have more experience, more richness of experiences. And as we move towards from a materialistic world to a more experiential world where experiences matter, I think you have both the experience and you're well positioned to tell these types of stories, to help those people in the center to maybe turn around and look at what's surrounding them. And I think in Sweden, it's been a country that has been looking in the center for too long. And we get glimpses of people like you, of one of my previous guests, for example, of Innocent Mugenga, who are people who are helping turn heads of people who have not experiences. And I think the work that you're doing is incredibly important for that.
Thank you. And I love, this kind of metaphor and the way you've described it, because the people in the center have to turn around to see the perspective and look at how, those around the perimeter and the circumference can not only see around, but they can also see the things that the people in the center miss. And I always use this as an example. My book, Lagom, is in 18 different foreign editions except Swedish. It's a book about Sweden.
Can you say that again?
Yes. Lagom is in 18 different languages, published in 18 different languages except Swedish.
Wow.
And this book is trying to give the perspective to those in the middle. It's the opportunity for those in the middle to turn around and say, oh, this is how the world interacts with us. This is how I interact with the world. It's not bad, it's not good, but this is how it is. And if you do not want to self-assess or self-audit or are given the opportunity to do so, then it's in the long run, it's going to be a problem. So this book, the Swedes that have read this love the book because it gives them, oh my God, I did not see it this way. Because I've been so close to this, I grew up this way, but I did not see that this was how somebody from the outside was experiencing me and my culture, right? So this book is like the being on the perimeter perspective for those in the middle to turn around and see.
I think it's well put. And this metaphor actually comes from one of my previous guests, Sebine Silasi, who is an author who wrote a book called You Belong. Yeah. But wow, it's going so well. Let me see. The good thing is I get to edit all this parts out.
Yes, no worries.
There is one topic I want to talk about, and maybe you can skip it or not, but there's a topic that I wanted to bring up, and I couldn't think of a better person to maybe discuss this with, and that's the issue of tokenism.
Yes.
Can you tell me your experience with tokenism?
And I address this a lot in this new book, In Every Mirror She's Black, because, diversity and inclusion is a really hot topic, and somebody said that diversity is who is in the room, inclusion is who has influence in the room. And so what happens with tokenism is that once companies kind of rush to try and diversify, then they pick one person and say, look, are you happy now? We've got the one person in this role, so you cannot say we're racist. And then they keep using that one face as the face of diversity in their company, but that person has no real influence, And so that's why I call tokenism in a sense. For example, I also looked recently at the website of a major Swedish bank, and I get it. they add photos of, you know, black people.
Sure.
And I scrolled down and it was mostly just black people. And I'm like, we're in Sweden. Why isn't it a bit more mixed? That is tokenism for me. So I get they're trying to make it diverse. They're trying to show a different, but it should show lots of different kinds of people, including black people. Then it feels more real. So that is when it's, for me, it's easy to know when a company is just being trying to pander. Because I'm like, if you're a company located in the north of Finland, that there's no black people, but yet your website is all black people, then you're pandering. It's just clear.
Right.
And tokenism happens when, you know, the people making the decision at the table aren't diverse. And I actually called this out recently. There was a website about, you know, supporting minority founders, like people that wanted to start their businesses. And so we applied for something. We didn't get it. But they then pointed me to that website for immigrants without even knowing if I was born in Sweden or not, right?
Right.
So they just saw my picture and said, okay, now this is a website for immigrants, right? Because they didn't know me, right? And so I went to the website, and the website had just pictures of black women looking at a laptop like they had not seen a laptop before. So I called them out publicly. I said, this is ridiculous. First of all, the website you're showing is that if you're brown, then you're not Swedish. You're foreign. That's what you're telling. So, and this is what Afro-Swedes that have born in Sweden, bred in Sweden, have had to fight all their lives. This is not right. This is tokenism. Stop it. You know. And so I called them out, and so they diversified the pictures. They made a, they fixed it. Is they had lots of, they had black people, they had, you know, Middle Eastern, they had white people that could be, you know, from Eastern Europe. It was mixed to show that an immigrant isn't necessarily brown. It can be anybody. So those are the things I kind of try to fight through my work with nuance as well.
Yeah, and tokenism sometimes is used as a shorthand for declaring they're open. I could tell you many stories about me being respectful of other cultures, and the easiest way to do it is just put a black person. But there is a flip side to tokenism, and there's a lot of power for being the first, for being the only one, and to breaking down these stereotypes. I'm thinking about you in Fiji. Mm-hmm. And you talk about how adventure sports used to be for white, usually men, but, you know, women as well. And in many ways, you have been the first one or the only in many, many situations. So by being the only one, you are providing like a pathway for those that follow, for saying it's not as daunting, it's not as daring to be the first one.
Correct.
Because I see Lola has done it before. So therefore, I believe. So can you talk about maybe that, do you feel that responsibility sometimes that you're opening the path for others to follow?
No, absolutely. I do feel the responsibility. It is part of my purpose to keep making it easier for others, but it's what I'm actually trying to show with my life is that you can just be and just live and do the things that truly excite you and live outside of other people's expectations of you, because that's when you become impossible to ignore. Because people are wondering, who is this person living outside of society's boundaries? And that's what I'm doing, like just living my life. So hopefully that inspires others to just be themselves, to not feel like they have to go be a lawyer if that's not what they want to do. And they, you know, so I guess opening those doors, when I go in, you know, when I make contacts, I do a lot of networking behind the scenes. I connect people. I open up opportunities as well. I lift the load off their backs as well. But overall, it's more living openly the way I do so that people feel like, you know what? I'm a black woman and I like punk rock, and that's fine. You know, I don't have to feel like I need to like something or be something or do something or feel this way, that I can just live unapologetically and, you know, use my voice. And I think that if you see over time, my voice has always stayed consistent because I know my voice. The tools I use to sharpen the voice have changed, you know, the media and the way I maybe tell stories, but the voice is the same because the person is the same. I've never changed that. I've evolved, I've grown, I've gotten more mature, but I'm still the same person. And I think that's reflected in everything I do.
I know you're quite big as a writer on metaphors. And yes. What I was imagining you opening the doors is eventually you grabbing the door, yeah. Getting rid of the doors completely,
yes.
and just have a very open
floor plan.
exactly. Which leads me to one question, and we're almost wrapping this up. What's your vision for the future? So you're helping a lot of people, especially people who are Black, women who are living in Sweden, because that's where you have an impact, with the greatest impact. What's that impact for? What is a future that you envision through your work and through?
I think we're tired of struggling and surviving and being invited in. We need to be able to just thrive and create our own spaces and invite others in, you know? And I think for me, it's very important for, you know, I always say Black women carry society on our backs. We've done it for centuries. Even in the U.S., we carry the voting on our backs. We're the ones that vote and make sure that, you know, racists don't get into power. You know, we show up. You know, over 95% of Black women vote for what's right. We are the backbone of society. We've done it for centuries, and yet we're the least protected, you know. And so my vision for the future is for us to just thrive. And, you know, I gave a talk recently and I showed a kind of provocative slide. On the one hand, I showed a photo of a Black woman and a white guy getting married. And then the next slide was, she was the boss of the white man. And I said, when do you accept Black women? Is it when you're marrying them, or, you know, you have a relationship with them, then they're okay, and then some of the other stereotypes you ascribe to them is okay, but then the same Black woman you take her to be your CEO, then she becomes this angry Black woman, and you pull all these stereotypes on her. That why can't you just accept in both scenarios? And that is what I'm trying to address in Europe. Because in the U.S., there are women like Oprah Winfrey, Black women in positions of power that run companies. But in Europe, that says we're not racist. Look, my wife is Black. Are you going to take orders from your wife if she's your CEO? So that is the space I'm really trying to talk to in my writing, especially my fiction now, and I'm going to explore a lot more of it, is when are Black women just allowed to be and to thrive and not be questioned, and to start removing those stereotypes surrounding us.
I think that's beautifully put. You, in your TEDx talk, you call yourself a metaphorical representation of why not. Yes. And we haven't touched on the topic of why not. I'm going to put a link to that talk and then people can see. But the way I see you here, you are a metaphorical representation of belonging. Mm. And before I give you the word for give you the last word, I just wanted to say thank you so much for taking the time. This has been a very enriching conversation. We didn't cover all the topics I wanted to get into, because I think I want to be respectful for your time and for my listeners' time, but perhaps we could do a part two or part three in the future. So is there anything you would like to say to my audience and anybody listening? And of course, if you want to also mention about your book or anything you'd like to say.
Yes, I mean, I think the advice I'll give is actually in the opening credits of the new book, is that for anybody who has felt excluded, uninvited, you know, unseen, that you're allowed to exist without explanation, your experiences are valid, your voice is valid. Never let the world convince you otherwise, you know. And I will leave with one of my absolute favorite quotes. It's from E.E. Cummings, you know, and it always says, and I will keep quoting forever. It says, to be nobody in yourself is to fight the hardest battle you ever have to fight in a world that's trying to make you everyone else. right? So never stop fighting that battle. So that's kind of what the quote says. You know, the world is trying to make you like everyone else. To fight that is the hardest battle you're going to have to fight to be yourself. So never stop fighting. So I think that quote is really touches on what I do in my life. So,
Lola Åkerström, thank you so much for being on Create Belonging.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Continue to fight for being yourself in a world that tries to make you like everyone else. I'm not at all surprised that Lola chose this quote by E.E. Cummings to share with us. After all, Lola is someone who continues to fight for being herself and continues to show us that the life you want is possible if you're just willing to go for it. I mean, why not? I love this conversation and I hope you did too. I'm curious if there's any parts that stuck with you or that you resonated with. For me, the part towards the end where she talks about Black women being the backbone of society, this reminded me of what Trevor Noah, the comedian, presenter of The Daily Show, and hopefully future guest of Create Belonging, what he said during his closing statements when he was leaving The Daily Show in 2022. And I'm going to play you the clip now. It's about 2 minutes long, but I hope that you can indulge me.
And this is random for some, but special shout out to Black women. I've often been credited with, you know, having these grand ideas of people like, oh, Trevor, you're so smart and you're so, and then I'm like, who do you think teaches me? You know? Who do you think has shaped me, nourished me, informed me? You know, from my mom, my grand, you know, my aunt, all these Black women in my life. But then in America as well, I always tell people, if you truly want to learn about America, talk to Black women. Yeah. Because unlike everybody else, Black women cannot afford to f around and find out. Black people understand how hard it is when things go bad, especially in America, but any place where Black people exist, whether it's Brazil, whether it's South Africa, wherever it is, when things go bad, Black people know that it gets worse for them. But Black women in particular, they know what shit is, genuinely. People always be shocked. They'll be like, why do Black women turn out the way they do in America? Why do they vote the way they... Yeah, because they know what happens if things do not go the way it should. They cannot afford to f*** around and find out. And to Black women who have taught me, all of them, I mean, the scholars online, the, you know, the authors, everybody, the Roxane Gays, the Tressie McMillan Cottoms, the, you know, I'll remember the names, you know, the Zoe Tzamudzis, the, like, brilliant, brilliant women have taken the time to inform me, to educate me, to argue with me. You know, the Tarana Burks who, you know, laughed with me, talking about everything from sexual assault to just what life is like. Yeah, man, I'll tell you now, do yourself a favor. You truly want to know what to do or how to do it, or maybe the best way or the most equitable way? Talk to Black women. They're a lot of the reason that I'm here, and so I'm grateful to them. I'm grateful to every single one of you. This has been an honor. Thank you.
Okay, I'm so glad that worked. And so if you could see how what Noah's talking about here is very much along the lines of what Lola was talking about. What's interesting is that I recorded my interview with Lola in 2021 and this clip is from 2022. As always, if you want to watch a clip from YouTube of it, there is a link in the show notes. So I also try to include some other relevant links of the people and the resources that we mentioned. So please go ahead and check those out. And that's it. That wraps up episode 10 of Create Belonging. Before we go, I wanted to thank you for listening this far. I wanted to thank all of you listeners who have been in contact with me over the last couple of months. Your feedback and your engagement means a lot. I am learning so much from you, and it really motivates me to keep going and continue this exploration of belonging. You can get in touch with me on LinkedIn, or you can send me an email at createbelonging@gmail.com. I reply to every single email and to every comment. I also have a small presence on Instagram, which I'm not really there, but feel free to try to reach me there. And finally, I wanted to thank Seth Godin for creating and inviting me to the Purple Space, which is a community of creatives where I'm getting a lot of feedback. I'm getting a lot of encouragement. And so thank you for those in the Purple Space. Seth, of course, is one of my hero mentors that I have never met personally, but I have exchanged a few messages and emails back and forth, which is just such an amazing feeling to be in contact with such an accomplished author and community builder. Hopefully I'll get him in the podcast in the future. And so that's it. But before I go, I wanted to remind you to go create belonging for yourself and for others. Thank you. Until next time.